I was in Susie's house looking for a cigarette. I knew I wasn't going to find one because she'd given up and hired a smoking agent to remove all tobacco products from the house every other day for a year. I had no cash, and to earn my keep, I had to stay by the phone and answer it and take messages. She made me do it in a New York gay accent so her friends would ask questions. In between phone calls, I thought about cigarettes. I thought about breaking off their filters and putting the ragged end in my mouth, sucking a flame into the leafy tube, inhaling very deeply and savouring the mild anoxic rush with caustic crumbs of tobacco stuck to my tongue and lips. I open the window. There's an office block opposite Susie's flat. Its smokers skulk in the lane at the back. Sometimes the smoke drifts up and in through Susie's window. Today, there was only the smoke from next door's incinerator. They have two dogs and they burn their turds in it. In desperation, I phoned an ad into Loot. Cigarette wanted, it said. Please phone Susie's number. The phone rang as soon as I put it down. Susie. She wanted her Astrakhan coat delivered to her office on the South Bank. I need it for six. I'm meeting a playwright. I knew what that meant. She has a soggy valve for writers. Oh, and could you change the sheets first? I wore the coat to make sure I didn't lose it. My arms are about a foot longer than Susie's. In the street, I pause by the smokers. Standing downwind and about 2 yards away, and breathing like a runner, I made good use of their fumes. They stared at me with some suspicion. I felt a little conversation would help. I don't work with you, I said. More stares. So I explained. No one answered the ad in Loot. They shook their heads and went inside. 2 hours later, I attempted the same method outside the stage door of the National Theatre. There were only two smokers, and the river breeze ripped their smoke up and over my head. I leapt and gulped, breathing 6 times too fast, and reeled giddily into the road. A car screeched to a halt and blasted its horn. I froze in shock. It drew up to my legs and honked again. I remained confused. There was a shout from inside. Then slowly, the car pushed me over. As I squirmed in the grit, trying to remember how to swear, I heard a brusque male voice. And on the basis of that, I'd say felling a pedestrian feels more exciting than shooting a cat with an air gun, but not as genuinely transgressive as coming in your mother's handbag. Susie's laugh coiled round this pronouncement, and she appeared tugging at the end of my arm. Stand up, she said, and meet Gobi Jovler. He wrote that play that won the awards. I remembered the critics had said that it was the most devastatingly accurate play that will ever be written about sex. It's the most devastatingly accurate play that will ever be written about sex, said Susie. Jovler looked younger than I had imagined, and meaty in the face. He was dressed smart, felty brown, as if for a photo in a colour supplement, and barking at a nervous stick with a handbook. The stick wrote everything down, including the volley of insults levelled at him, and laughed through a sycophant's fringe. Jovler inspected the front of my head. Is this the one that fancies you, Dessouze? He was clearly amused. Susie giggled. Jovler jabbed a few words at the stick, something like, casting note, an underdog so ugly the audience is incapable of any sympathy no matter what befalls him. Then he turned to me and said, you may follow at a discreet distance, I have a plan for you. Do you have a cigarette, I wondered. What sort of fart skull are you, he sneered. Was I not holding a lit cigarette in last month's GQ? Could I have one then, please? You can have a whole box if you can tell me the name of my next play. His last play had been called Fuckers. More Fuckers, I said. Sadly, it is currently nameless, he laughed, but if you do turn out to be right, then you may find your scroungings in Harwich." And he lopped the box into the river. Susie and Jovler led me by 20 yards along the promenade, with the stick one gruff remark to their right. Twice they stopped and held hands, gazing at the roof of the theatre, while Jovler's name swept across the light display. Once he bawled me out for blocking the view of his poster. When we reached the bridge, he insisted on repeating the stroll because he'd only been recognised by 5 people. "You said you only wanted 5, said Susie. "Yeah, but 3 of them recognised me from the telly," he snorted. And we traipsed back and forth 2 more times before he announced that he and Susie were going to get pissed in a limo. Jovler's driver slung us over the river. Jovler and Susie helped themselves to the car bar. Watching this, the stick's eyes bulged, and he reminded me of a featherless anorexic owl I'd dreamt about in hospital. Jovler poured him a large colourless one. "What do you do?" I whispered. "Neat gin," he replied. But Jovler had heard me. "Daniel is a scribe, cursed with the intelligence to know he will never be a first-rate writer, and enough ambition to rot horribly in this knowledge, until in 20 years he claims that he wrote all my plays and shortly afterwards drinks himself to death." Daniel snivelled before Jovler cut him off with, "No time to laugh, fuckpen. Get it all down." Later I found a note in my pocket which said, "I don't write his plays. It's the actors who do that." We toured London in great random sweeps, Jovler all the time extemporising on urban alienation in the sexually malfunctioning zeitgeist. "Look," he'd say, "look at them. Dual income, 6 dildos." And once, "If you're bored of London, you're bored of fucking. And I'm bored of fucking London because I'm bored of London fucking." This last, the stick applauded until he was slapped. By the time we reached Susie's flat, Jovler had pronounced himself ready for the final act. As he dragged her to the chamber, he called over his shoulder to the stick, "Tell New York I'll be up for an hour." Susie wondered if Jovler might give me a few cigarettes so I could remain in a fug at the breakfast bar while they got torrid. "No, no, he's part of the scene," he said. He leered at me like a randy bandit and waved a box of cigarettes under my nose. "Fancy one?" I did. "Then you must witness the tup." With that, he shoved Susie onto her four-poster and started to savage her bodice. Stick sat me down on the floor. "It's where they usually sit," he said, and wrote feverishly as he spoke. I glanced up to behold Jovler, now naked and kneeling before a slightly ripped-looking Susie. "Gobble my stoppard," he ordered, and fell on her in such a way as to bring this about. As he pushed himself into her face, Jovler turned to me and said, "How does it feel to see the woman you love being plugged by me?" An unborn scream burst in my stomach and spread like cold mercury through my chest. I put my hands over my face but kept looking through my fingers. "Write that down," he panted to the stick. "Visibly destroyed but can't look away." Then he whipped Susie round so her forehead slapped the wall and declared, "Mr. Stoppard will shortly be entering his box." Hammering continued for ghastly minutes until the mobile phone which Jovler had gaffered to his buttock chirped a manic arpeggio. He ripped it upwards, listened, stopped mid-thrust and shouted, "Not now, mammit, I'm fucking." Then he beamed the hideous grin of the undeservedly successful and slapped Susie quite hard around the face to celebrate. Now I could turn away, and to the sounds of this dubious pleasure, I began to ponder a vague tumescence of my own. Eventually, with a series of pathetic squeaks, the playwright emptied himself in the region of Susie's chest and armpit. She didn't seem to notice. By this stage, she was mainly asleep. He lit a cigarette and ordered his amanuensis to read back his notes. "Good," he said frequently, and "Hmm, Pinter," before dropping the butt in my lap and pronouncing himself pleased with a decent first draft. Then he told the stick to leak the Mamet episode to the Sunday Times. "I'll deny it in my next interview," he said. "That's how it's done." "Leave now," he said to me, and the stick prodded me through to a large sofa where I dragged urgently on the soggy filter. Through the stripped pine I could hear Susie, awake now and softly sobbing, accompanied by the fart of his voice, which had taken on a new, almost pleading tone. "I hate the slapping too," he was saying. "It's just that, well, it really is the thing now, you know." 3 hours later he was gone, and I was asleep in the bed next to Susie. She'd called me in to cover the damp patch. I slept fitfully, tormented by febrile visions of a Jovler rampant, until Jovler's voice jolted me too. It was mumbling through the answer phone. "De Suze," it was saying. "You do love me, don't you?" "Yeah, I'm sure you do, yeah." "All right, good. Hope you're not too, you know. And, hey, a voice behind him prompted something inaudible. "Yeah, it was a fuck supreme. You are the Marquis of Muff." There was a loud clunk, but the phone didn't ring off. And for some minutes I heard Jovler explaining to the stick how this last phrase would work at the National and would be quoted by 20% of the audience in the interval. And he would hear it, because he has a special window for listening.